All right, good afternoon, everybody. This is the Joint Interim Task Force on Oregon Retirement Savings, and we have a jam-crammed, packed agenda today, but I think it'll be a very good agenda. I want to thank people who are returning guests for providing a lot of information and suggestions on who we should meet with and who should come before this committee, and I hope that you'll see, based on the lineup, that we've taken your input and requests seriously. We obviously want to cast a broad net as we're discussing this very important issue. And without further ado, I'll turn this over to Jan to make an introduction of Grant Boykin.
Mm-hmm. Committee members, we've invited Grant Boykin for with the California Treasurer's Office. He is the acting director of the Secure Choice program that is similar to what we're looking at. They're doing some research, and he's going to talk about the research that they've gathered. And let me just tell you else on the agenda. We're going to then have Gregory Tooman come and speak. He's with DHS OHA. They've done some analysis of the public assistance benefits for retired persons. And then we'll have a discussion of the types and access of plans available through employers and individuals. And Harley has been invited to kind of lead that discussion. So if Grant wants to come forward.
Do I need a microphone?
It's on.
Oh, it is. Okay.
This is your packet.
It's yours.
Oh, thanks.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the task force, for inviting me here to sunny Salem today. I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you. And Grant, just for the record, if it's ever over 80 degrees, you do not have to wear a tie in the great state of Oregon.
Well, I did not know that. I figured.
I know this is just a typical day in California.
So I appreciate that. And let me just say for the record that our office, I work for State Treasurer in California, Bill Lockyer, and our office over the years has had the pleasure of working with Mr. Wheeler's office, and I think we work quite well together.
It's a great relationship.
Yep.
Thank you.
So just a little bit about me. I'm currently serving as the acting director to the California Secure Choice Retirement Savings Investment Board. In addition, my roles at the Treasurer's Office is to work as an advisor on issues related to public employee benefits and insurance. I serve as one of the Treasurer's representatives on the governing boards of several organizations, including the two pension systems, CalPERS and CalSTRS. For more than a decade, I've been working a lot on issues related to public employee benefits, which in California are quite adequate. And so when the job of serving a board that's looking at how to increase retirement security for a population of the California workers who have very little, when that fell in my lap, I was pretty enthusiastic about it. I thought what I would do today is I'd like to stick to about 20 minutes and then open it up for discussion and questions. But I'd like to frame my remarks around three questions that I think all of us in Oregon, California, who are working on retirement security initiatives, and also in the growing handful of states that are working on similar initiatives, are grappling with. The first is the question of whether retirement security is a problem that needs to be addressed. And then the second question is, if so, does the solution lie in establishing something new, some kind of a new program, or is it better served by looking at incentives and initiatives to increase access to and participation in existing retirement savings plans? And the third question is, depending on what the answer to the second is, what should it look like? What does that solution look like? So I'm going to explain how the legislature in California essentially answered the first two questions. Yes, retirement security is a problem, and yes, it's a problem that requires creating a new program. And then I'll discuss what our board is doing to address the third question, which is, what should this thing look like? How should it be designed and administered? But before I get into that, let me just give you a brief overview of the Secure Choice California Secure Choice Retirement Savings Trust Act, which we call SB 1234 or 1234. So the purpose of the act was to address the problem of retirement security for the estimated 6.3 million private sector California workers who don't have access to retirement savings through their employers. The intention is to create a low-cost, low-risk, portable savings plan with automatic enrollment, although people would be allowed to opt out, in order to maximize participation. The idea is to create a plan that would overcome the barriers that keep individuals from from saving on their own, and also the barriers that keep employers, particularly small employers, from adopting or implementing retirement savings plans. By statute, Secure Choice can't create any liabilities for the state of California, for the taxpayers, or for employers. The law requires that the program be exempt from ERISA, and it requires that the accounts created under the program would qualify for favorable tax treatment, and the program also would have to be self-sustaining. But before the program can become operational, the Secure Choice Board has to conduct a study, a market analysis, a financial feasibility study, to determine whether the conditions can be met to make such a program operational. And then they have to return to the legislature with the study, their recommendations, and wait for authorization to actually implement the study. And I think I speak for the entire board when I say the study is really key. There is nothing in our minds that's pre-cooked about the outcome, either in terms of the findings of the study or what the study's findings will determine in terms of the direction of what a retirement savings program should look like. And because we have to return to the legislature for further authorization, it's really important. We all see it as important that the study's done. It's got to be thorough and objective, and it's got to be considered as such by stakeholders as well. So to the question of, is retirement security...
Grant, could I interrupt you? I apologize, because you're laying this out in an excellent way, and I appreciate that. Were there any resources allocated to the committee? And if so, could I ask what those resources were?
Okay, I was going to get to that, but that's an excellent question. So the study has to be conducted entirely with donated funds, which is a bit of a hurdle, but I think we're making progress. And before we had donated funds, the treasurer's office was essentially absorbing the cost. There's a couple of attorneys who help, to work on the project, but then it's pretty much myself and one other staff members. It's our other duties as required, part of our job description. But we are now raising some donations that we'll be able to reimburse the treasurer's office and pay the outside contractors. But
thanks.
That's a good question.
I appreciate that, Grant. Thank you.
So, and feel free, anyone, to interrupt me as I go along. So is retirement security a problem that needs to be addressed? I think the fact that SB 1234 was passed certainly sends a signal that the legislature thought it was. I think we all know a lot about the national figures, the gap that people talk about between what households should have saved for retirement and what they actually have saved is measured in the trillions. 6.6 trillion is a measure you see quite a bit, but I've seen ones that are higher. Median account balance, the Employee Benefits Research Institute research finds it's about $3,000 for a household. More than that as households get closer to retirement, about $12,000. The Boston College Center for Retirement Research, in a recent brief, found that roughly one-third of all households reach their 60s with no retirement savings plan at all. But that's the national picture. And I think for the California legislation to be successful, it was really important to have some California-specific data. And in 2011, UC Berkeley's Labor Center issued a call for paper on the retirement prospects of workers in California and about solutions, state-level policies that could improve the financial situation of California workers. And the papers were written. It culminated in a conference in November of 2011 that I think really gave a lot of momentum to the legislation, which was introduced shortly after the conference. But just a few highlights from the body of research is it found that 85% of California workers in the bottom quartile of income, so earning less than about $21,000 a year, are projected to be at or below 200% of the poverty threshold at age 65. And that measure, 200% of the poverty threshold, was used by the research because they say in a high-cost area like California, that's a useful measure for determining whether people will have what they need to live. And for the middle 50% of earners, so from $20,000 to $70,000, about half were expected to be below that threshold of 200% of the poverty line. Most of the lowest income retirees in California, the majority of their sources of income for retirement come from Social Security. So for the bottom quartile, about 80% of all of their retirement income is from Social Security. Women and racial and ethnic minorities are disproportionately represented among...
I didn't quite get that. So for the bottom quartile, you said 80% were relying exclusively on... Is it 80% of the bottom quartile?
For those people in the bottom quartile, on average, 80% of their income comes from Social Security.
Got it. Thank you. Sure. Got it. Thank you.
Ask a clarifying question? They're already in retirement, and these are income levels.
Yes, so it's
in retirement.
Income in retirement.
Okay.
So 80% of the income for the bottom quartile in retirement is Social Security resources.
Right.
Got it. Okay, good. Thanks.
Women and racial and ethnic minorities are disproportionately represented among retirees in the bottom quartile of the retirement income distribution. And among individuals projected to retire into poverty, the findings found that about two-thirds are women. The set of studies also looked at access to retirement savings plans among California workers and concluded that workplace retirement plan access in California is inadequate. It found that only about 45% of private sector workers aged 25 to 64 in California work for an employer who sponsored a retirement plan. That's less than the national average, that's around 53%, and less than the 50% level in California from about the year 2000. And access to employer-sponsored plans is lowest among low-wage workers, employees of small firms with less than 100 employees, and Latinos. So research on access and participation isn't perfect. It isn't without its flaws. And we may hear some more about that today. But one of the common critiques pointed out is that most of the research on access and participation looks at a snapshot in time. But if you look at a worker over the course of their lives, sure, younger workers are less likely to participate if they do have access, or they're less likely to have access to a plan, but that younger worker will eventually become an older worker who's more likely to have access and to participate. But to me, that doesn't negate the fact that there is a problem with access, because I think all the experts agree that steady savings over the course of the career, especially started early on, are very important to building a secure retirement.
Well, and that's just the basics of investment strategy, right? The earlier, the more, and you get larger savings towards the end of your career. It's the same as any other retirement or investment vehicle.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Yeah. And another figure that I've heard is if you look at average job tenure hasn't changed that much over time. It's about 5 years. So if somebody works a 40-year career, they're going to have about 8 employers over the course of that time, and about half will have had retirement plans. But again, that argument doesn't... there's still that issue about the need to steadily be contributing, and somebody who had a plan 10 years ago isn't still contributing to that plan if they've left that employer. The next question, what I really want to get onto is where we're at now and where we're headed, and I'm sure that's what you want. But the question of if retirement security is a problem that needs to be addressed, how did the legislature land on the idea that what we need is a state program to help people save? And SB 1234 is clearly intended to study a state-administered program, although it's not clear exactly how that would work. Probably some sort of private-public partnership. Senator De Leon, who was the author of the legislation and who is poised to become the leader of the Senate in California, let me back up. He used to talk about the impetus for this legislation as his 70-year-old aunt, Francisca, who at age 70 is still cleaning houses and who has never had an employment sponsored retirement savings plan. So for him, he knows it won't help her, but it's a lot of his thinking has to do with his aunt who raised him. But in addition to his aunt, he was also advised by a behavioral economist. So Richard Thaler from the University of Chicago, Shlomo Bernardzi from UCLA's Anderson Business School. They talked to him a lot about what the research shows about incentives, individual behavior when it comes to retirement savings, and really convinced him that to move people in the right direction, you need to design programs that make it easy for people to do the right thing, to save, and don't require a lot of proactive steps to save. And both of those researchers talk about the success where they exist, automatic enrollment and automatic escalation features really, you know, are greatly
successful. Can you explain auto-escalation, please?
Yeah, I mean, there's different flavors, different types of it, but it would be a feature in a retirement savings plan where either triggered annually, the percent that they're contributing would increase by, say, 1% annually until they rise up to a certain point, say 12 or 15%. Or the other way it could work is have a trigger where each pay increase, you have an increase that's proportionate, so you're still contributing the same amount, but you don't have to proactively think, I got a pay raise, I should adjust my contribution. And again, and these are all questions that, you know, they're explored largely for the people who do have employer-sponsored plans, who are a different group probably than the population that we're looking at for Secure Choice in California, which probably have lower income. So, the concept of making it, and for automatic enrollment to work, I don't see any other way really than to touch the employees at the workplace. And so that's how the legislature and how Senator De Leon really thought what we need is a requirement that employers offer automatic enrollment savings plans at work. And there is some support among experts. The Employee Benefits Research Institute does an annual retirement confidence survey. And in the 2014 report this year, they note, workers are more likely to save in a retirement plan at work than they are to save on their own through an IRA. One of the things they consistently find is that in terms of predictors of success in retirement savings, having a plan at work is a significant predictor. The Center for Retirement Research at Boston College issued a recent brief that was trying to look at why lower income individuals are so much less likely to have retirement savings or adequate retirement savings. And the brief concludes by suggesting that automatic enrollment might increase take-up rates, but it would only work for those who actually have a plan at work. And so their big conclusion is, quote, the most potent approach for boosting retirement savings participation would be requiring employers to offer all workers access to a retirement savings plan that includes automatic enrollment.
Can you explain what take-up rate means?
Oh, take-up rate is the percentage of people who work for an employer who have a plan, who actually take the plan up, who actually participate and contribute.
How is it calculated?
So it would be, I guess, the percentage who work for an employer and are eligible for the plan. You know, say there's 100 employees, and all of them are eligible to participate in the plan, and 50 of them do, you'd have a 50% take-up rate.
Thanks.
So the final question that I wanted to address is, where are we now? How would a state-administered savings program best be designed to address the problem of retirement security? And I have to be honest, when Jan called me or contacted me first, and then she followed up with an email that said, we want to know how you addressed the ERISA issue and a couple of other things, and I thought, I'm not sure if I still get the invite, because we aren't as far as maybe some people think we are, or as far as we would like. We have a lot of work to do and a lot of hurdles to overcome to get there, but I wanted to share today four milestones of the progress we have made and sort of tell you the direction that we're headed. So the first accomplishment, I would say, is that we have a board. That wasn't the case last year at this time. The legislation went into effect January 1st, 2013, and we didn't have a quorum of the board established until July, so couldn't have our first meeting until September. But we have a 9-member board, only one vacancy. The governor has a small business owner appointee that hasn't been chosen yet. But other than that, it's filled out. It's the state treasurer, state controller, Department of Finance, or director of finance. And the governor has four appointees. Senate and the assembly each have one. When we finally did have a meeting in September, we released a request for information. Just wanted to, we didn't have any money to start the study, and we thought that's one thing we could do is just seek input as widely as possible. So we distributed a request for information, and we were pretty encouraged for the most part with the responses. We received responses from a wide range of people, experts, academics, financial service companies, industry associations. So we're fairly pleased. We did receive a healthy bit of skepticism from some quarters. The insurance industry had a lot of skepticism and was concerned that what we would be creating would compete with existing products in the market and wasn't needed because there's already products out there.
Could you be more specific what the RFI was looking for?
Good question. So what we did in the RFI was we had a set of questions. A lot of them were asking about if we did have this state-administered retirement savings program, what should it look like? What would make it appealing for vendors to participate with us? What would make it appealing for California's workers that currently don't have access to savings plans at work? What would make it appealing for them to participate? We also asked a bunch of questions about how we should proceed with our statutorily required study, our feasibility analysis, who we should be looking for to help us with the work. And we asked questions about, we're required to be exempt from ERISA. Do you have suggestions for how the program could be designed, structured, administered, how the roles and relationships could work so that we would be considered exempt from ERISA?
Did you get good answers on that, just out of curiosity?
We had a wide mix. Some, a lot of the financial services companies said, yeah, we're pretty sure you could, as long as you structure it following the safe harbor rules. Employer can only take on the job of passing through the payroll deduction, but can't advocate, can't contribute, can't market. You should be safe. But, the one agreement we had from both skeptics and supporters was you're going to have to go to the Department of Labor and to the Treasury to get, definitive answers about our tax and ERISA questions.
Right.
And we're going to have something that's a lot more well-defined than what we have in statute before anybody's going to be willing to give us a definitive of some sort of formal opinion. So,
good. Thank you.
So the California Chamber of Commerce and some other employer representatives, I think they have a lot of concerns about, even though the law says no liability, no burden for employers, they aren't sure if there's a slippery slope where maybe we aren't going to, will require or mandate employer contributions later, which I think if we're exempt from ERISA, that's not really a possibility because we could not, unless ERISA changes, we could not have employer contributions. But I think they're just concerned generally about the, the possibility of liabilities and burdens. Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, SIFMA, and the Investment Company Institute expressed a lot of doubt about whether the program was possible, whether it would be exempt from ERISA. But we took a lot of comfort, or we're quite pleased in the fact that some of the members of SIFMA and the Investment Company Institute, some of the most prominent member companies, gave us request for information responses that had a lot of enthusiasm and suggested that there were products that met our needs, that they would be even willing to offer through Secure Choice, that the program was viable. So we heard from Aon Hewitt, BlackRock, Tiacraft, Prudential, State Street Global Advisors, all together about 15 responses from companies within the financial service sector. Their recommendations in terms of, do you default people into a target date fund? Do you have some sort of insured products with annuities? That varied quite a bit. But I guess the takeaway that we were left with is that, companies out there feel there are products that exist that would fit within our goals of creating a low-cost, portable plan.
Grant, is that information that you'd be willing to share
with
yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, it's
since
all
you, you've already web, gone out and asked, it's all available?
It's all available on our webpage, and if, but it, in terms of getting it to the task force, would it be best for me to work through Jan to get that? Okay.
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah, we're if I had had a PowerPoint presentation, I could have put the URL
never works.
Up there. But
never
yeah,
works.
Very transparent. Okay.
Thank you. And I appreciate the fact that California has taken the initiative on this, and the leadership role means you've asked a lot of the right institutions and yeah. private sector businesses for the information. There's no point us asking for the same information.
No, and I agree, and I'm watching closely what's happening in other states, because actually I'm hoping maybe something will happen that will allow us to piggyback. Maybe somebody will
go. We're following you. We're following you. You're doing fine.
All right. And then just two other points. The third one is we've actually made some fundraising progress. We have always set as a target the goal of raising $1 million to complete our market analysis and feasibility study and even the legal work that needs to get done to draft the right questions to the Department of Labor and the Treasury. We don't know if that's accurate or not. That's based on asking the right people or who we think are the right people in the industry, plan administrators, consultants. And to date, we've raised $251,000. SEIU in California donated $1,000, and they were the first. And then we have a challenge grant issued by the Laura and John Arnold Foundation. They'll match each $100,000 increment up to $500,000. So we now have $100,000 from them to match the SEIU Foundation. And then we had an outgoing state senator who gave us a donation of $50,000, and a former state controller, Steve Wesley, who is going to help with the fundraising effort, but he put in $1,000 of his own as a personal check. And then I can share, because we made it public at our board meeting, AARP, the Ford Foundation, and an organization called the California Endowment, which usually works on community health issues, but that, you know, income is very much related to health outcomes, and they see our goals as being somewhat aligned. And so I can't give dollar amounts. We don't have firm commitments, but they've expressed interest, and so we're going through that process with them. And then the last thing that I will share is in January, and we're still working on it each board meeting, the board has come up with a plan for how to go about doing the studies. It's a plan for contracting with the right people to do the studies, I should say. And the board agreed that the first thing, we need to have two requests for proposals. And the first would be to get legal expertise, somebody, a firm with experience in D.C., and maybe a second one, a firm with experience in Sacramento, to help us, you know, guide us through the process. But the reason we want them early on is because we're going to have people who are ERISA experts helping every step of the way, both in the market analysis, but also in the part where we design the program, because we'd hate to get down the road of, we did the market analysis, based on that we designed this program, but then bring the lawyers in and they'd say, that's never going to fly. And so what we'd like is then to have the legal team that we bring on board help with the RFP process for the market analysis and financial feasibility study, and if possible, get the team together, you know, as closely together as soon as possible so they can start coordinating and working together. But as I said, you know, fundraising, we aren't there yet. And at our board meeting yesterday, we had a robust discussion about how to stage the RFPs in relation to what we actually have, the funds that we have. And we have not come to resolution on that yet. We're hoping that by the end of May or sometime early in June, we'll have a lot more in our fund, in our account, so that we'll be able to go out with at least the first RFP.
Could I ask a basic question? I'm sorry, I'm not an attorney, so I may be asking a very foolish question.
And I'm not either. So.
Okay, good. Then we between the two of us, we'll come up
we'll
with half
an
answer.
Yeah.
The legal analysis that you require in order to do the RFP for market analysis and the feasibility study, you mentioned ERISA attorneys. That's all federal statute. What I'm trying to figure out here is, you know, I think it's really important for states to share and leverage off of each other their information, experiences, and whatnot. I'm assuming that there are there issues specific to California law that shape these policies, or is this really a broader look at federal policies under ERISA?
I mean, I can't think of anything California specific. I mean, for us, I think we're thinking of it as purely a question, you know, to the Department of Labor. It's a purely an ERISA question.
So there are 14 states currently looking at these issues, and all of them will need to, at some point, have clarity on these issues.
Right.
Have you considered a coalition?
You know, in a perfect world, and I would like to start working, and I have sort of had informal discussions with a lot of other states, including a Tea Party-backed treasurer in Indiana who is very excited.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah,
Murdoch.
He was very supportive of
it. Yeah, I mean, for different reasons.
Issue.
I think it's got both the personal responsibility and the helping angle.
Yeah.
But, yes, I have, and I would love for us to be – I mean, we have very limited staff, and I'm always managing the expectations of my board and saying – you know, we have to do things with donated funds. We have two dedicated staff at the treasurer's office. It's not our full-time job. So, but anyway, in answer to your question is, I do think that would be very important to have a coalition because we're all going to be needing to ask the same questions and to the extent that we can work together and also show that, you know, I tend to think that the more states that join that effort, the more that Washington's going to have to say, we better figure this out, figure out how we're going to treat these things. And my understanding, I'm not an expert, is that's somewhat the genesis of the 529 plans.
It was, yeah. It started, the state
started,
really
yeah.
pushed the federal government
yeah.
into a supportive position.
Yeah. So. And that's really all that I had for my prepared remarks. I'm happy to answer.
So Grant, you mentioned the first RFP would be once you had enough funding. Do you guys have a number that you're trying to get to say, hey, that's enough to start spending? Or
so we've always thought a million, we hope we'll do it or we'll make it fit. And we hope that's sufficient. I don't think we've quite decided. The chair, who is the treasurer, has felt we should have that amount before we go out with an RFP. But we had a board meeting yesterday, and I think the majority of the board, it was just an information item. We're going to kind of wait and see what happens by the end of May or the start of June. But I think the board would like to go out with at least the first RFP, you know, assuming we're halfway there. So, and if you're headed toward timeline, it's been very hard. I'm always asked what our timeline is. Since we have to go back to the legislature, I can tell you if we wanted to go back to the legislature next year, I think realistically we'd have to have a study done by, say, September or October with a good set of recommendations from the board, you know, by the end of the year, so the legislature has time to look at it. And I think at this point where we are with the fundraising and given how long the RFP process can take for state procurement, it's not always fast and nimble, we may be looking at going to the legislature not in 2015 but in 2016.
I ask a follow-on question then. So on your RFP, are you looking to boil the ocean, or are you guys going to try to segment it down into certain areas and certain questions?
So, I mean, that's a good question, and we haven't quite gotten there, although we are starting to draft it. Originally, what we had thought is are you talking for the RFP for legal services or for the market analysis and financial?
Well, more for the market analysis.
Yeah.
So.
So originally what we staff had suggested to the board is that we have two separate ones for the market analysis and financial feasibility study because the legislation and the statute actually requires survey research, surveys, focus groups to get better information on the target population and their employers. And so we saw, you know, the perfect fit would be somebody who does market research for financial services industry. And then there's this financial feasibility piece and the program design piece, which we saw as separate disciplines. But the board, I think, kind of felt it might be quicker to mash that all up into a single RFP and hope that good teams come together. So that's where we're at now.
Can the new effort at Georgetown be a leveraging opportunity for you? There's the financial services industry, some of the labor unions, AARP and others, are creating a Center for Retirement Security at Georgetown, which, Tom, when will that be operational? Yeah, so there might be another opportunity. Yeah. Again, they wanted to look at issues of national consequence that everybody will need addressed, so there might be an opportunity for you.
No, and we've talked with Kathleen Kennedy Townsend.
Exactly, very good.
Several times, and so we're keeping in touch with them and what they're doing, and you know, we are not in a position to turn down any help, and we're looking at ways to leverage, you know, anything that we can. We do have our state procurement rules. We've had organizations approach us about taking on some staff work. And, you know, I think because it's got to be board controlled, the board would have to go through, even if the donation of staff work was in kind, we'd have to go through our normal procurement process for that. But, I mean, I just have to say and keep repeating, we're still very much at the early stages.
Right.
Can I ask a couple questions of you? I found myself starting to go around and around a little bit. That I'm understanding that you're undertaking a feasibility study, a marketing study, and then there's legal questions related to ERISA. And these are leading, there's going to be a request for a proposal to get the marketing study and the feasibility study. Won't those require something from ERISA already? I mean, is there a little bit of circularity in this?
You know, concurrent and coordinated streams of work that need to happen. And so, yeah, your question about won't the market analysis and feasibility have to be informed by some ERISA expert, I couldn't agree more. And that's why the board has said what we need first to bring on board is the legal team, outside legal counsel.
Okay. And the feasibility study, let's say, I'm assuming the ERISA issues are what do we need to do to not run afoul of ERISA rather than what do we need to add to ERISA. So you get the answers. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but you get the answers and they say there's nothing in the way of doing this thing. What does the feasibility study look at then? And is the marketing study just a survey of the landscape, or will something like this...
So,
is there a market for something like this?
Right. In answer to... Well, yeah, so the market analysis, the idea is, will feed into the financial feasibility. So if we're okay, good to go on the ERISA question, then the next step is, okay, well, based on how we've designed it and how Department of Labor signed off on it, based on what we learned in the market analysis, how many people are going to participate?
Okay.
And will that pencil out? Is it going to be self-sustaining? Will there be enough interest from vendors to, you know, participate with us?
Okay,
so
I'm less confused now.
Good. I don't know if I'm always less confused, because it's complex work that has to be done.
I do a follow-on to that. So you mentioned the state administrative program. Is there a vision for what that means, or is it?
I think there's many different visions for what that means. Part of me thinks the 529 model that we have, where we have a state board and then we have contracts with investment consultant, and currently TIAA-CREF administers the program, that might be a model. The statute does allow for the possibility that the board could contract with CalPERS to manage money, to administer the program. So I think that's all part of what needs to be answered in the study.
So I have a question, and following up on the Georgetown point, there are a lot of smart people at smart universities in California, and there's already, for example, the 2011 study. Have you explored the possibility of one of the universities taking this on? And wouldn't that be less expensive, a state university, than...
Yes, and we, you know, I don't want to get ahead of the board, but we've had a lot of productive conversations with UCLA's Anderson School of Business.
Mm-hmm.
They held a Secure Choice Symposium for us last March. So Senator De Leon's office worked with the Anderson School, brought together a lot of the financial services companies that responded to our request for information. They had a panel of academics that kind of bounced ideas after the presentations. And then we had a really good presentation from, I've forgotten his name, but somebody who was very much involved and in the creation of and still involved in the administration of NEST, the UK's National Employment Savings Trust, which in a way is quite similar to what we're doing in California, similar in scale as well. And so we are definitely exploring those options because there's academics who are very interested in seeing how they could partner with us.
I'm trying to remember from the things I've read about California Secure Choice, there is a small population that is not, would not be eligible for this. Is that right? Or did I misread something?
Our employers that employ less than five.
Okay.
But say for the self-employed and for anybody else, even employees who already have something at the workplace, the legislation requires the board to, or allows the board to look at options to allow people to enroll on their own. And then, yeah.
If they're already covered, they wouldn't be eligible. Or if they're already participating in something.
Well, if they're already participating in a workplace plan, the statute actually allows the board to look at ways that if those people want to come to us and participate, they could.
Okay, so, but if I heard you correctly.
But the employer mandate is not. If an employer already has a workplace retirement savings plan, then it's. And then they are not required to participate.
Okay. And if the employer has less than five employees, did I hear you?
Then they are exempt as well.
Okay.
Can you tell? Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have a question, Ian? Just jump right in.
Okay. Thanks. What is the contemplated process for employers that may have a plan, but you have some qualifying period, some waiting period, to access it?
That's an excellent question, and I would say, based on my read of the legislation, that it's not anticipated in that. Say there's a five-year window that you have to work there before you participate. I would say that question is left open in the legislation. Actually, the way the legislation reads, I would say that that person would be an employee who's working for an employer without a plan or
without
a plan for that person. So but that's a good, and there's a lot of complexities, and I forgot to mention that in addition to details like that, what about the employer who has a qualifying period? Just the task of setting up payroll deductions, figuring out how to communicate, and we think it's a very diverse population, and geographically, I mean, California is huge, so figuring out how to communicate and how to do the payroll deduction, we have a lot of challenges in the study.
May I ask a follow-up?
Sure. Sorry, but
So what, you know, it sounds like the employer spot on the board is the one spot that hasn't been filled, and so, but maybe that some of the other folks also are employers, but what is the employer community kind of saying about this? Because the idea of setting up these mechanisms, it's not nothing.
Yep.
But of course, it's a good value that, you know, it's a good idea.
Yep. And we have thought that is a position that does need to be filled, and trying to figure out this particular governor's appointment process is not something we've been able to do. So I don't know if we have a time frame, but I would like it to be as early, you know, as possible, before we go too far down the path of the RFP. We do have a board member, Heather Hooper, who works for a firm that helps small businesses set up retirement savings plan, and she speaks quite often about barriers to employers, reasons employers don't want to set up retirement savings plans.
Can I follow up on Ann's first question? To help me understand, if, say, an employer, we have a lot of, in Oregon, tax-exempt organizations often employ two, three, or four people. If they have, for example, they've been able to fill out the form and set up a SEP IRA, Simplified Employee Pension or Plan IRA, but they have the option when they create the plan to designate how much of a wait there is, 0, 1, or 2 years. So they select 2 years. They hire somebody. They have to, that person, there's no contribution made for that person for 2 years. would, if I understood you correctly, they would be, that person, that employee would be an employee without access to a plan, at least for those 2 years? You don't know yet.
My best answer is I'm not an attorney.
Okay.
I have read the legislation, but that's not a question that I've thought of. But I think it's a good question, and I just wrote it down.
Okay.
So that's, you know, I'll follow up with our attorneys and get back to you.
Okay.
But that is, and there's a lot of complexities.
Technically, they're covered.
Yes, but it's just not
they
yet.
They can't, right.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate on some of the potential barriers to employers that you just referenced?
Yeah, and I'm not an expert,
but
I actually asked our board member, who is more expert than myself, if she could give me some of those. And one of the biggest things she points to is employers, especially small employers, they went into business because they do whatever business they do. They build something, they have some service they provide, but that expertise that they have and that interest they had is not employee benefits. And so it's hard for them, and they don't have a lot of time to figure it out. And especially for small employers, it's hard to get a low-cost plan. You don't have the size or the leverage to bring fees down and get a plan that would be good for your employees. And you know, her point too, and I'm not an expert because I can't speak to it, but a lot of the ERISA and a lot of the rules around defined contribution plans put a lot of accounting burdens on employers, a lot of extra work that they have to do that I think they're concerned about. And so that's part of what California Secure Choice is trying to figure out. Is there a way that we can take that on, the board, the program, so that employers can say to their employees, hey, look, there's this thing we offer, but they really don't have to do the, they don't have to worry about the liabilities and burdens.
So you've exempted employers with 5 or fewer employees. Have you taken off the table some sort of a broader solution where they could voluntarily participate in something other than a Social Security-like plan?
No, I mean, we've exempted them from the mandatory
participation. From auto-enroll, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Okay.
But what we would like to do is set up a way to allow any employer, and maybe some employer would want to offer Secure Choice for some of their employees, but not for others. And so we'd like a way that any employer could participate.
And the employees, of course, still have the option to go through an IRA,
right.
The variations of an IRA.
Yep.
Okay.
It's a, if it is, it's automatic enrollment with an opt-out.
Got it. Okay.
So I've got a question. When you were talking about the second question of should it be something new and how do we do this, and you came around to this idea of the behavioral science and how people react and helping them make better decisions, making it easy to enroll, auto-enroll, is there any educational component of what you're looking at to help folks that maybe haven't made that decision in the past? I understand there's an auto-enrollment, but there's also sort of an understanding that needs to happen. How do we make sure that folks...
I think they're
getting into
just like what we require with our 529 plan administrators, whoever administers this, we would require that education be a very significant component of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've heard behavioral economists say you can have financial literacy as much as you want, and it's a good thing, but it doesn't move behavior as much as people would like it to, because
right.
We're creatures not of necessarily rational choice, but of, whatever human foibles and quirks we have, and so a little paternalism and pushing people in the right direction can go a long ways toward getting people to save.
Has the board considered an approach where employers provide the information, that there'd be a portal, and that employers provide the information, but that the employers not be the enrolling entity? And if that was one of the options considered, how was it decided to not go that route?
We have not gotten that far yet. The one thing on that the legislation does, does include is that we can look at options of working through our employment development department, reaching out to employers. But there's nothing set in stone about how that would look.
So is it right to understand that it's still sort of an open question whether or not employers are the enrolling people or employers provide information about the product and the employee themselves is the one that either signs up or doesn't, which is, I think, maybe more like our 529 plan approach?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what's envisioned in the law is that the board would look at ways through the Employment Development Department where that department could distribute to employers packets that the employer would have to hand out. But then there would have to be some sort of a payroll deduction mechanism. And so, we haven't defined how that would work and what that would look like yet. I'm sorry, I don't have more definitive answers, but that's part of what we're doing is
Yeah, Grant, we appreciate that, and we're all aware that you're still in the early stages, and you've made that very clear, and we're appreciative of what information you're able to provide us. Building on Ann's good question, is the assumption in auto enroll that each employer would have to create their own auto-enroll mechanism, or is the broader assumption that there'd be some sort of a template?
No, there would be. In fact, the law says that the board must create some sort of an information packet that gets distributed automatically and includes an opt-out forms. And, you know, I think if we went back to the legislature, we would have to set in statute, you know, at least some of the language, and it would be a standard thing that the board creates and the legislature, puts into law. Here's what that information packet looks like.
So it could be, you know, you mentioned Tia Cref, and mm-hmm. we all use Tia Cref as part of our 529 college savings plans. Or at least it seems that way, doesn't it? So just to help me understand the basic mechanics of this, I'm an employee, I get a packet, and it says, here is your retirement plan that we are offering, and if you want, fill out page 2 to opt out. And if you want to be part of the plan, here's how it works, and it could have potentially Tia Cref's information, and then I sign up on Tia Cref's website. Is that one option?
I think that's still an option. I think, however, we can do it simpler. I mean, the simpler option is, I mean, to me, that seems simpler, and simpler seems more, you know, possible. We haven't ruled that out.
How would it work just conceptually and hypothetically? And we're just brainstorming. Yeah. I'm not holding you to anything. I'm not establishing policy. I'm just trying to figure out how these things even work.
I might offer something here.
Yeah, sure, Jim.
Though fear to tread there. In another life, I'm also on the advisory to cover Oregon. And if I could say, whatever you do, don't choose Oracle for producing,
thank you,
generating
for not saying anything.
This. But there might be some vision in the what was our anticipated plan for small business through Cover Oregon, which is that the unlike as it is now, where the employer who does cover their employees in health care has to figure all this out every year based on what employees and what network and all of that, the employee would be directed to Cover Oregon. The employer would set their contribution. This is what I'm willing to contribute. The employee goes to Cover Oregon and looks at the various carriers, the various plans, makes their choice, and then pays whatever difference there is between what the employer was offering, and the administrator of the whole thing for small business was going to be Cover Oregon. So cover, so the employer gets one check or one bill a month based on what their contribution was, and the rest of the administration is between the employee and Cover Oregon. One of the advantages is if an employee goes to a different employer, all of those sorts of things, they have their account is with Cover Oregon. So there were lots of advantages to that vision, and there might be as well some way that that could be done, it seems, that the employer turns over the documents to the employee, the employer decides what, if any, contribution, and then whatever the state contractor or whoever is running it for the state would handle it.
No, I think that's very appealing to me. And again, I have to say we haven't gone down the path of deciding what it should look like. And I think that is that would be much easier.
Could you tell me about the where was I going? This is, never mind. Somebody else till I remember what I was thinking.
So can I try to address your enrollment question? So basically, you have to give participants the ability to read the material before they, as they opt in. So if you're even doing all auto-enrollment, you still got to give them all the material so they know what they're being invested in. And then they have to have the ability to opt out. And it has to be some type of paper today. That's, you know, part of the regulations that are required, right? You can't even do it electronically. You have to actually physically provide paper. So those are things that, you know, State of California is going to have to figure out. You know, can we do it electronically? Can we do it different ways to actually try to get to the broader base of people?
So I do remember my question. Now, you'd also mentioned one broad strategy was potentially to contract with CalPERS or CalSTRS to manage the resources. How would that work? Just in a conceptual...
The law doesn't make it clear how that would work, and it only mentions specifically CalPERS.
Right, it only mentions CalPERS. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
And I think it would be, you know, the board can contract with CalPERS to manage money, to administer the program. It's not well defined.
And that would be as an alternative to a TIA CREF-like model.
Yeah. So,
okay, I see. I gotcha.
And then, but the other question is that would be a board decision by the pension system, and you know, the California Secure Choice I don't think could require CalPERS to take on.
Well, you can't commingle the funds. Right?
Well, I mean, that's an issue that CalPERS would be very concerned about, especially as the IRS is taking a much closer look at, you know, with respect to public pension system, what counts as a public agency, what doesn't. And so I think they would rather not head in the direction of making the IRS question the extent to which that wall between the private sector and public sector is being broken.
Since we're imagining some things, if I could follow up on Jim's thoughts, I don't know how many employers, I assume almost all of them in the state, pay the quarterly taxes online. And all of the employees that are employed are listed along with their Social Security number. It's past secure login. Does California have a similar vehicle? And if so, would it not be possible?
And that's our Employment Development Department. Right, okay. And so that's why the legislation kind of anticipates that's something that the board should explore.
That there'd just be, if I hired an employee, I would, and I was paying the quarterly withholding to this on the OQ or 109 or whatever it is, I'd type in a new record. They would be, and just they'd be automatically, if it's auto enroll, unless they opted out with their paper form, they would be enrolled. And as an employer, I would just be, I think the number I read in a lot of the suggestions was 3%. 3% of their payroll would just be added in. And the state would dun my business account, checking account, or bank account for that amount of money and allocate it according to that form.
No, and I think that is part of the idea of getting our Employment Development Department, which collects payroll taxes, involved. And I should note that 3% default contribution is something that we had a lot of different responses, and it varied. And, you know, one of the common responses is, that's not going to do it. That's not going to get people to retirement security. But then at the same time, we don't know that much about the liquidity needs of a lot of the target population. And so we're not sure yet what's possible.
I just used that as an example.
Yep. Anne, you had a question?
Thanks, yeah. So I think, you know, we're having a conversation with you, and we're also sort of having a brainstorming here, and I hope that's okay.
This is not ideas that I haven't thought of, and I'm not a technical expert on a lot of this.
Well, we're really grateful that you're here. And so this is throwing out an idea for our body, you know, for your input and the input of others. If one of our needs is going to be having a level of touch on the employers who are dealing with this that's light enough that the employers are willing to be supportive of this project, which I think is a real issue, you know, one thing for us to consider is, mechanics-wise, how we do it, whether or not we do it as a... the 529 plan, I believe, is a checking account automatic deduction that you sign up for when you sign up for it. And I was just sidebarring with Harley to understand this better. But, you know, if we heard from employers that they were very concerned about administering in-house this program, but we wanted it to have favorable tax treatment, you know, one thing that employers might be able to do is offer the information at onboarding, but it goes from the employee's checking account, like my 529 plan contributions do, and so the employers are not necessarily right there in the middle of it, and I think we still get some kind of favorable tax treatment. So one option for us to consider that is a lighter touch on the activities of employers than some of the alternatives.
You left the door open to Ann's point. Mm-hmm. You, and that's a provocative thought. I think it is worth a discussion. Absolutely. To Ann's point, obviously the 529 IRS tax code changes required Congress to actually do something. That's probably not going to happen in the next year or two. You can certainly leave the door open to that, and that would be very helpful to the states, obviously. Is there something you are considering in the state by way of tax favorability?
I don't think, I mean, we're just now, I don't know what you have for your 529 plan in Oregon, but we haven't had anything for ours in terms of tax favorability, but the Treasurer Lockyer is pushing that this year. Okay. So we haven't, there's nothing in our statute that talks about that or talks about the possibility, but like a Savers credit or, we haven't gotten that far yet, and I hate to keep repeating that, but.
Okay. Just curious.
That is a good thought, though. And I also keep thinking, and I've heard of other retirement savings initiatives that use tax time, tax refunds as a, you know, a touch point to get people to take that refund and do something. And I think, you know, there's potential there for if we did set this program up to, you know, have something tie in with tax refunds.
The real tension, it seems to me, is, you know, how you used the word paternalistic earlier. You know, obviously with auto enroll and making that a mandate, you're going to have higher participation and presumably higher savings rates. With more of a 529-like model, it's completely voluntary. It's more of an opt-in option. It works very well for those who actually participate. But you have smaller, much smaller, in fact, numbers of participation. So I think the real challenge for us is figuring out where, and the challenge for your committee as well, your board, is where do you want to draw that line? And that, frankly, requires a lot of interaction and conversations with the stakeholders to find out where they would be willing to have that line drawn.
And on that point, you know, with our 529 plan, and I'm sure yours is the same, the distribution, I mean, disproportionately, it's the more wealthy people who participate in 529, and so that's what makes automatic enrollment appealing. But at the same time, my fear is we turn the switch on and we have all these people saying, the state's taking my money, you know, and you have to, that's a balance we're going to have to come up with, is how to reach people, how to set the contribution.
I think that's really the key question, right? The key question is, you know, You know, because I can see both parts of that argument. I love our 529 plan. It's, you know, recently ranked number 3 in the nation, but let's be honest, it's a very small percentage of people who actually participate. And if I could be so bold, it's not the people who we need to be saving for college.
Yep, I agree.
I need to be saving.
And Ann. That's what a lot of grill do for you.
I don't know if you have these kinds of numbers, but...
And we have about five more minutes.
When this bill was being developed, and since, was there any look at what impact this would have on retiree utilization of state resources in retirement, food stamp programs, those kinds
of things? No, and that's... We've tried to get... You know, we don't have the bandwidth, but we've tried to get other organizations to look exactly at that question, because I think a large part of the argument is there's a huge proportion of the population reaching that retirement age and can no longer work, and they haven't saved on their own. That's got to mean there's more strain on the safety net, but we haven't seen any studies that exactly look at, you know, if we put together something like this, how much less strain will there be? How much savings could there be if people save on their own? But I think that'd be great research to see. I mean, I think a lot of that savings probably is, you know, a lot of federal money, because a lot of the assistance is federal. So I'm not sure if you might be difficult to model at the state level, but I think it'd be good to see that work.
And the calculus of this, I mean, in essence, the cohort that would, if this went into effect, everything was done and it started tomorrow, it's that cohort who's some age, 40 and younger,
right,
that would actually be have the advantage of that program. We'd still have a long-term, although declining, numbers that would need access to those other right support programs.
Although, I mean, at the same time, when you look at 3% contribution rate, maybe, maybe more, it, you know, we have, the senator is now calling it a supplement to Social Security, not necessarily the whole package. So, you know, a significant dent, a good thing, but not necessarily the whole solution.
Okay. Any further questions for Grant?
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we really appreciate your being here. We know you've got a lot on your plate, and it was a big commitment for you to come up here. And I think this has been very, very helpful to our discussion, and it's helped us leapfrog in terms of what the issues are and the question marks and some of the issues we should focus our time and energy on. So, Grant, I really appreciate it. And as always, we've had a great relationship with the Treasurer of California, Bill Lockyer, and if you could please pass on his regards from all of us. And thank you very much for your participation.
I will do that, and we're going to be watching closely what you do up here.
Great. Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, next up, we have a couple of discussion topics. The first is types and access to employers. Sideboard, one moment, please.
Treasurer Wheeler, we were going to jump to this. This is the third discussion item.
Oh, great.
Item.
Okay.
Gregory Tooman.
Okay, Gregory, you're on. We're jumping ahead. Thank you.
Sorry, Chairman.
Okay, give it to Jessica.
We need to get more time.
Task Force members, Gregory Tooman, this is a perfect lead-in because the last question to Grant was about social programs, and the task force was directed by the legislation to look at the impact on public assistance benefits from retired persons who do not have enough retirement income, and that's a very specific question, but Gregory's shop is able to put together some information on use of public assistance benefits by people age 60 and over and 65 and over. Go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
My name is Gregory Tooman. I'm a forecaster with the Office of Forecasting Research and Analysis. It's a shared services division of the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services.
Thanks, Greg, for being here. We really appreciate it.
I'm happy to be here. I have a PowerPoint because I can't talk without a PowerPoint. It just doesn't happen anymore.
We all have a copy of
great
the presentation.
There's a lot of numbers in this presentation and in this report. I'm not going to be going over each one of those. If you see something that you'd like me to discuss further, interrupt me and ask, because I'm going to go, this is a once over broadly, because it is a very numbers intensive piece of work. There are approximately 825,000 Oregonians age 60 and older, and 572,000 of them are age 65 and older. About 8.6 of those age 60 and older are living below the poverty line. 43,000 of them, or 7.5% age 65 and older, are living below poverty. This is from the U.S. Census Bureau's American Community Survey. That is a much lower percentage of those in poverty than you'll find in the general population in Oregon, which is more like 17.2% of everyone living in poverty. As a general rule, people age 60 and older are among the least likely to live in poverty. The data I'm going to talk about today is based on cases in the calendar year 2013. It will show data for persons age 60 and separately for people age 65 and older. Obviously, people 65 and older will be entirely within the other category of people 60 and older. Data for the enrollment in long-term care and medical programs, because they are partly paid for through Medicaid, are somewhat provisional. Still closing the books on the end of 2013. This is going to be revised, and the final numbers for 2013 participation in the programs will be a little different than what you see here. In fact, I'm going to caveat a lot of things I'm going to say today. This is considered to be a general overview, giving an idea of magnitude, especially of the dollars. We would probably have liked a lot longer to prepare to get right down to the precise figures that you're looking for. So these are kind of averages.
Can I ask a question, Gregory?
Yeah.
So how many Oregonians, 21 to 60, roughly?
Well, let's see. We have about 3.89 million people.
Thank
so
you.
It's whatever minus what I said before.
That's what I was looking for. Thanks.
We're going to be at 3.9 sometime this year, I believe. On our way to 4 million rather quickly.
Thanks.
The largest growth is in young adults. First, I'm going to take a look at SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which replaced food stamps. SNAP participation among people 60 and older tends to be a bit low nationally, comparing to the level of poverty among people 60 and older, but not really true in Oregon, where SNAP participation is actually very high. The breakdown of folks on SNAP, you can see people 60 and older, and this slide shows the total number of people who are on SNAP for at least a month in the year. We don't tend to show our data this way mostly because some people who are on at the beginning of the year won't be on at the end. Some other people will come on during the year. But if you are on SNAP for 1 month out of the year, it's in this total. 60,900 plus are 65 and older out of a total of over 100,000 people. The largest group is between 60 and 64. The majority of cases are over 64.
So just so I understand, are you saying 60.8% of the people in Oregon on SNAP are 65 and older?
No, that's 60% of the total number of people on SNAP who are over 60.
Ah, got it.
So this
thank
is
you.
Out of the total universe
okay.
of people we're
okay,
considering as the retirement age population here. It's the total caseload for SNAP is about 1.07 million people. That's touching SNAP 1 month in a year. Our average monthly caseload in 2013 was between 675,000 and 700,000 people. That represents 9.3% of the total caseload of people on SNAP were 60 or older. 5.7% of the people on SNAP were over the age of 65. If we look at an average monthly caseload, which tends to be how we budget, you'll see that over 79,000 per month people age 60 and older were on SNAP. The cost per month calculation there would bring it out to $18 million plus. Age 65 and older, it's $50,500. and the total cost per month is over $11 million. This is a bit of a high estimate, and the reason is because it's based on an average SNAP payment of $228 per person, which is a bit high, I'm sorry, per household, excuse me. But people 60 and older tend to live in one-person households more than any other age group, and so this is a bit of a high estimate. People over 60 make up about 9.6% of the folks per month on the caseload. And so at over 100% poverty, we're actually getting more people than the U.S. Census Bureau said were in poverty in the SNAP population. And the reason for that is that we tend to extend SNAP participation up to 133% of the federal poverty level, so you get some people that way. Also, there are some groups who are disabled who can be over that 133% of the federal poverty level, all the way up to 185%. And folks 60 and older tend to be more likely to be disabled than other groups. So we have over 100% participation just on the idea of being over 100% of the federal poverty level. Long-term care is services provided to people who have difficulty with the activities of daily living. It's essentially can include traditional nursing homes, but it can also include alternatives to that, including in-home care and community-based care. These all cost very different amounts, so I'm presenting them separately. In-home care, as it sounds, is care to people in their home. It can be only a few hours a day to as much as 8 hours or more. Community-based care is up to 24-hour-a-day services. It's very often adult foster care. And then they have traditional nursing care with complex medical needs met and things like that. The long-term care caseload, over 163,800 or age 60 or over, are in our long-term care caseload. Those age 65 or older make up the vast majority of them, or 83% of the total of our population, 60 and older, are over 65. Cost for the long-term care caseload, this is a little tricky. People based on their health needs will be in one type of care and move into another type of care based on acute or chronic problems and then back into their original placement setting. So if anyone is in the most expensive care setting for even one day in a month, we count them in that group for the month. So, for instance, if you're in nursing facility care for even one day in a month, we count you in that rate group for the month. If you're not in nursing facility but in community-based care for even one day in a month, we count you there. If you're in neither but in home care, we count you there for the whole month. Based on that, the average monthly caseload for long-term care of people 60 and older is 22,857. Of those, 19,510 are age 65 and older. You can see the cost per case increases as you go from in-home to community-based and from community-based to nursing facility care. And you can see the total costs there. 2.8% of all Oregonians over age 60 are in long-term care. 3.4% of all Oregonians over 65 are in long-term care. 32% of Oregonians 60 and older and in poverty are in our long-term care population. 45% of those 65 and older. In addition, I should point out that our aging and people with disabilities group within the Department of Human Services has an additional about 120,000 Oregonians over 60 served in non-long-term care services. That can be short-term care. It can also include some in-home services not considered part of long-term care, and OSIP and some other cash-related services. 100,000 out of that 120,000 are age 65 and older. Medical assistance programs are administered by the Oregon Health Authority. They provide health care coverage for low-income Oregonians administered through the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. The primary source of funding for this is a combination of Medicaid funds and general fund and some other funds, including tobacco taxes, and so forth. In calendar year 2013, the total number of persons receiving medical assistance through the Oregon Health Authority was a little over 1 million, 1.07 million. 9.2% of them were age 60 and older, and almost 7% of them were age 65 and older. The age breakdown of folks in our medical assistance program, 60 and older, is here. The total is 98,911, and again, that is the cumulative total of people over the course of a year. Age 65 and older was 74% of our total MAP caseload. I should say that most of these people are in Oregon Health Plan, but not all of them are. There are additional programs that are not part of Oregon Health Plan. The primary types of Oregon Health Plan Plus cases that we have include aid to the blind and disabled, in which you have to be considered either blind or disabled through Social Security disability, old age assistance, which is for folks 65 and older, and TANF-related medical, which is for families with small children but can have some folks over 60 if they're the caretakers of children. OHP Standard was a program that existed for folks who otherwise would not have been eligible for Medicaid. It has been abolished as of January 1st due to the Affordable Care Act, and those cases were rolled into Oregon Health Plan Plus. I'll talk about that again in a minute. Other medical assistance programs that are utilized by folks 60 and older in the state include dual eligible clients who are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. Essentially, Medicaid pays first, and additional payments for co-payments and deductibles are picked up by Medicaid. The Citizen Alien Waived Emergency Medical, or CAWEM, program, which is emergency services for non-citizens. And then the Breast and Cervical Cancer Program, which is a very small but rather expensive program. This is a breakdown of those 60 and older, 65 and older, based on these programs. I won't go over all of these, obviously. One of the things to keep in mind is Medicare plays a big part in whether or not we pick up costs through Medicaid and the other medical assistance programs. You'll notice, for example, in aid to blind and disabled, it's 16% of the total at 60 and older, but at 65 and older, it trails off quite a lot. And that's because a lot of those people become Medicare eligible, most of them, and they transfer out of that program. Same thing with Oregon Health Plan Standard. The average cost per case here was very dicey to get at for the reason that a lot of our caseload is handled through a managed care paradigm, paid for through coordinated care organizations or CCOs. But some of our caseload is not. A lot of those folks are Medicare eligible because Medicare is a fee-for-service program and we have to adhere to that. But even those that aren't necessarily Medicare eligible, some of them are still fee-for-service for reasons that are pretty complicated to go through here today, and I don't even know all of them. So this is an average cost per case across both of those paradigms. Obviously, the managed care group will be less cost per month per case than people who are in fee-for-service. And you can see the average cost per case for these different programs in the total. Monthly, and then the average monthly caseload and the total cost per month. And again, this is for folks 60 and older specifically. Based on this average monthly caseload, people over 60 make up, or the people on our caseload over 60 make up about 8% of the total people over 60 in the state, and about 8.5% of people over 65. In poverty, our caseloads in Medicaid over the age of 60 is 93% of the total in poverty. For the 65 and older group, it's slightly over 100% of everyone in poverty, age 65 and older. And again, because some people qualify at higher income because they're disabled.
Can you say that one more time? I'm sorry.
I may have mangled that just
now. No, I don't think you did. I just...
So for the entire population of folks age 60 and older, 8% of them are on Medicaid or other OHP service. 8.5% of those over age 65.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Could we get you to go through the remainder of the slides because I want to make sure we leave plenty of time for board discussion. So if you could just sort of get to the bottom lines on these slides. They're great slides, and it's useful information, but I don't think we need to go through line by line.
Let's see. I was just going to mention the impact of the Affordable Care Act just quickly to sum up. The Affordable Care Act extended Medicaid coverage to folks up to 138% functionally of the federal poverty level. This included folks who were qualified for OHP standards, so that was folded into that caseload, so now they're OHP plus eligible, as well as other folks who were not qualified for our medical services. Most of those are adults. The expansion group mostly impacted folks between 60 and 64 out of the retirement age folks we're talking about because they're not Medicaid, Medicare eligible yet. Mm-hmm. We don't have solid, complete numbers for how ACA expansion has impacted folks 60 and older. These are very preliminary numbers. As you can see, 93% of those who were on OHP standard and enrolled in OHP Plus due to Affordable Care Act, and those recruited, especially during the open enrollment period between October and December, that pre-enrolled people into the new ACA adult category of coverage, 93% of those folks were under 60. Of the remainder, most of them were 60 to 64. That tailing 65 and older group of about 140 or so people, I am imagining they are most all right around their 65th birthday and going to be transferred, and they're just not quite Medicare eligible yet and finally considered to get that first month's Medicare coverage. So 6.8% of folks 60 to 64, or 6.8% of the total ACA expansion is folks 60 to 64. So that impacts our caseloads a little. And we don't have costing information for the ACA expansion group yet. We can mention that it's 100% federally funded at this point and will be until 2017 where it starts to tier down to 90% federally funded. Any questions?
Any questions for Gregory?
Or me?
Great. Thank you. That was a lot of information in a very short period of time. We appreciate it.
No problem.
All right, Harley, you're up. You're going to take the lead on our next discussion and topics, the types and access to employer-sponsored plans and individual retirement products and estimates of savings Oregonians have upon retirement and the amount recommended for a financially secure retirement.
Big topics.
Those are big topics.
So I'm going to do a handout for the task force just to help me with the thoughts, and you guys can follow along. So what's available, you know, and I think Grant hit a little bit of this. I'll probably duplicate a lot of what you talked about earlier, but I'll put a different light on it. You know, we know that, you know, IRAs have been around, Roth IRAs have been around. You can walk into a grocery store today, go to a bank, and open up an IRA. So the question is, why don't people do it? And, you know, you can go online, you can go through any of the major sites, you can go through your bank, your credit union. 10 minutes later, you can have an IRA set up, going. You can have automatic deduction from your checking or saving. Again, people aren't doing it, right? You know, so it's out there. Those tools are there. They're very easy to use. They're very easy to get signed up for. But again, you know, we know that people are not using them. I'm not going to talk about the wealth of different financial avenues there are for savings, so I'm not going to talk about annuities or life policies. It's a whole different can of worms there that are not necessarily, you know, focused only on retirement. You know, the federal government's doing my retirement account that I'll start later this year. It's similar to what a Roth IRA will be. It'll be after-tax dollars. But the key thing here is it's payroll deduction. So I know that Grant talked about that a little bit. You'll hear me talk about payroll deduction a few times because that, to me, the auto enrollment, it's a great plan design. We got to have that capability doing the payroll deduction first because that's the real limiter today of getting people to actually, the employers actually want to be able to participate. So, you know, my retirement account is, again, focused on low to mid-range earners. And, again, it's very similar to one of the things they're talking about in the state of California, which is like an auto IRA payroll deduction. So that's available today or will be available by end of the year. what I want to do is talk about page 3, and that's where most of our conversation will be, and just talk a little bit about the landscape of what employers, especially smaller employers, have at their disposal. You know, again, the MyRA will come out late this year. Dick mentioned this earlier, but the Simplified Employee Pension Plan, again, that will set up individual participant IRAs. This one, though, is a little bit different. It's employer contribution only, so actually employees do not contribute. So why would companies set this up? Why would small businesses set this up? You know, if they want their employees to participate with them on the profits and be able to share in some of the profits, it's set up to allow that to happen. It's set up to deal with seasonal industries and you know, companies that may not have high profits one year, but the next year, because of the deals they're working on, be it construction or other things, they'll have a big profit that they'll want to disperse with their employees. So it's a very simple filing initially to get it going. And then the nice thing here is there's no annual filing requirement. There's no DOL paperwork that you have to do on an annual basis or IRS. So there's, you know, it is what it says, Simplified Employee Pension. So that's one way to get in. Another way that small employers can get in is through the simple IRA, which is Savings Incentive Match Plan for Employees. Again, individual IRA accounts at the employee level. What's different here, though, is there is a match component that the employer can do. So depending on how the plan design is set up, depending on if the employee chooses to participate or not, there's a match that goes with it. Now, this one is set up only for employers that have less than 100 employees. So, again, something that was thought of before of, you know, how do we make it a little bit simpler? No annual filing requirement on this one either. So, again, you know, there's no testing. There's no, ensuring that all the calculations are correct happen anyway. But, again, it's simple. It's easy. It's low cost for employers to do. But this one comes with a match, right? So now we talked a little bit about, you know, what employers are trying to do, and it's something that Grant said, which is it's a benefit, right? So when you look at your wealth of benefits that you're offering your employees, you know, the retirement plan becomes part of that benefit package. And that's really where the 401k, and I included the 403b because we have a nonprofit person on our task force. But again, that is an employee contribution plan. It's a benefit. It's a payroll deduction is part of that program. Though here you have to meet ERISA, DOL, and the Internal Revenue Code rules and guidelines that are part of that. So it's a very, you know, this is where it gets complicated because within the 401k space, there's probably about 7 different derivatives we can talk about. And that's where a lot of the complication comes from. But one of the things it does do, it gives you broader investment options. So depending on what type of platform you're on, you have a much broader choice of funds that can go in there, types of funds that can go in there. And again, it's back to how a company wants to look at that benefit and how they want to actually provide it. The 401k is flexible. It is a recruitment tool for a lot of companies. It's why the matching is part of it. But you do have the DOL and IRS filing requirements on an annual basis. So it's a little bit more complicated. When we talk about companies that are, you know, 5, 10, 15 employees, you say, oh, they're not going to do a 401k. You know, some of them will if they're in a highly technical space where they need to recruit employees, and that becomes a differentiation compared to the next person they're going to go work for. The last one, which we talked about a little bit last time, the defined benefit plan. A lot of defined benefit plans have a defined contribution aspect to them where employees do participate as well. The difference on defined benefit and the reason why it has decreased in volume over time, it's really costly to set up. It's really costly to administrate on an annual basis. It's extremely complex with all the rules that you have to follow. You have to have actuarial support because of the modeling that you have to do and the definitions you have to provide. So it becomes extremely complex. There's probably about 40,000 of them nationwide at this point. And, you know, it continues to decline. We believe that if interest rates ever picked up here in the next couple of years and more plans got funded, you would actually see that number start to decline probably further. So that's a quick nutshell. When I'm done, I will provide you this lovely little sheet that lists all of them and the complexities around them, so you guys can read that at your leisure. I didn't want to take that apart. But what I want to do is call up Sven and Roger to have them talk a little bit about how they talk to employers, since I'm one step removed. You know, we work with people like Sven and Roger that actually deal with employers directly. I would like to call you guys up and just have you guys give a simple story on how you guys would talk to an employer about their choices and some of the things that you guys run into on a daily basis.
If you could just state your names for the record, and I also hope when you give your presentation, could you differentiate between small and medium and large size employers, just so we understand some of the different dynamics?
Let me make, I'm Roger Beyer, I'm a lobby for NAIF Oregon, and I'm going to let Sven do this presentation because he actually works with employers on a daily basis. I just work for them in front of you.
You see how it rolls, like Sven? You see how this works?
Thank you for
it all rolls down.
Provide the information, and they waste my Sven.
Went from me to Harley to Roger and right into your lap.
There you go.
Well, my name is Sven Anderson. I'm a financial services professional here in Salem, and I've been in the industry for about 17 years. I work with clients individually and small businesses, which I'll define in just a second. I'm also a member of the NAIFA Oregon, which is National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. I'm actually the state president for that association on a volunteer basis.
Thank you.
So when I think of small employer, it's a little bit different than when we talk about small companies or things of that nature. In the Salem area, a small employer is quite small. I would judge it in my business as 25 employees or less, but it's oftentimes much smaller than that. But oftentimes in the state of Oregon, a small employer might be considered 200 employees or less. So, but I think the companies that I primarily work with are these smaller tier companies, say 25 employees or less. And when I have engaged them in a conversation about retirement planning or benefits for their employees, generally what piques the interest is if the owner has some interest in the product themselves, not the product, but the idea of saving for themselves, or they have employees that have been asking about it, or it's important for them, or they have some maybe some recruitment issues, or they're looking to retain some highly trained professionals. So that's when it becomes a tool for the employer then to maintain his high level of workforce.
So when you're actually in those discussions with them and we talk about the types of plans that they can do, how's those discussions happen? I mean, do they say, hey, I want a 401k plan, and do they actually know what they want, or is it basically you have to walk them through the different options?
Generally, everybody's familiar with the phrase 401k, but most people don't know it's an IRS code, but that's what they say. They want a 401k, but then we begin to find out what their needs really are. So there's a fact-finding discussion that takes place. We find out how many employees they have, what their level of expertise is, really what the employer wants to get out of it, and so forth. And generally, with these smaller companies, a 401k is not really the right answer for them. It's, as Harley mentioned earlier, it's expensive, it's cumbersome, it's elaborate, it may be more than what they need. But as mentioned also, sometimes a simple IRA becomes a solution that is quite fitting because as many as 100 employees could participate. The cost to the employer is virtually nothing. Really, the only cost to the employer is the time maybe to do the accounting to send the payroll dollars out. Otherwise, the cost is absorbed by the employee or the participant, which is relatively small in that respect also. And then the employees have the ability to, because it has an IRA status, to take the money out at a later time if they want to put it into a individual IRA or something of that nature and manage it in a different location.
So let me ask you a question on that, because that's actually a really important point, that the cost to the employer is minimal. It's probably to their advantage from a recruitment and retention perspective, and yet Harley started off by saying they really touch a very small portion of the market. What do we think the obstacles or the barriers or the misunderstandings are that lead to a fairly low participation rate amongst employers?
Well, in my opinion, I think many times the employer understands their employees. And if you're in a construction field or a manual labor field, they know that their employees won't participate. They want their cash, and they're going to spend it, and they're not going to participate. I even was part of a 401k presentation for a company I was helping to set up, and you know, we did the presentation for about 40 or 50 people. Most of them were laborers, and I think none of them participated. We ended up having about five or six managers that participated, but the comment that some of them made was they'd rather keep their money in their sock than put it somewhere. And some of these were first-generation Americans that maybe didn't understand some of these products that are intangible. You know, it's one thing to have a dollar bill in your hand. It's another thing to see it go away and then get a piece of paper saying it's somewhere else. So that's for young employers or employees and maybe first generation Americans, that concept takes a little while to get hold of.
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's one of the things that we talk about all the time is, you know, it is an intangible. You're selling something that they don't get to touch, right? You know, and for a future promise that'll be larger than what they're putting in today, right? So it's a tough concept. I mean,
Sven, how, and I don't mean this about you personally, generally speaking, how would somebody who is selling this product, how do you make money off of it? If you go to a company, is it the number of people who actually participate, or is it the product, or is it the assets under management? How does that actually work?
There's a number of different ways how it works, and it really depends on the company that you're representing, but there are a number of different models. But generally, it's around the asset that's being contributed. So there's generally some type of a, we call a trail commission or something, based on the number of assets that you accumulate. And sometimes there's a commission, an upfront commission with some certain companies, and there's a wide variety of products that we can use in this arena. But it's not generally a highly profitable necessarily.
So you have to sell it twice, really. You have to sell it to the employer, and then you have to sell it to the participants to get them to actually put their assets into the plan.
Yep. Right, you do. And in fact, you know, oftentimes the motivation that I have as a entrepreneur is to help develop that business relationship with the owner, and hopefully develop other business opportunities with him. And this is kind of a means to an end, because he sees a need for it. I've done a number of different types of these plans where, with a labor type company, that we get some participants, people that come in and participate, and they're young people, and we kind of sell them on the idea, and then when I meet with them individually, I kind of sell them on not the idea, because I want them to understand this is not a good place to save for their next car, for a house, for an emergency or anything, because it's really not that kind of a tool. And I almost try to dissuade them. And they understand that, but they want the match, so they participate anyway, and then in a year, 2 years, they take their money out and take a penalty, and I've seen it happen lots.
Can you help me understand a couple things? When you say you just use the phrase the labor type company, what does that mean?
I'm thinking of employers that employ people that do manual labor, so like construction companies, roofing companies, landscape. You know, where the labor force is typically young and maybe less. Maybe it's going to be transitional. A transitional workforce,
but that workforce if I'm hearing you correctly, that would be a construction employer that's not participating with the union in a Taft-Hartley trust for those employees.
I would assume so, right? Because they would already have a plan,
right.
And they're usually larger employers, I think, that have the union shop.
Yeah, if you think about like a small roofing company where you got 5, 7, 10. People. I mean,
yeah, 15.
That's
guys,
the type of size we're talking about.
Generally speaking. So, yeah, and this will be the hardest gap to reach, because the other challenge is the employers, you know, they're trying to make payroll, and they're trying to get their next big break in business. And sometimes, as much as they may want to have a plan like this, it's just another distraction toward their main goal, which is to continue to build their business and stay in business.
Okay. And when you say plan like this, with all the plans that are out there, can you help
specifically
me?
Referring to perhaps a simple IRA, because it generally fits this group the best.
Okay.
because of the low costs, and it's easy to access. But I have small, simple IRA employee plans in companies that have two employees or one.
And when you're talking about the products that you're selling them, are you talking about like a Schwab IRA or a Fidelity IRA, or I don't know.
Primarily mutual funds through a mutual fund company.
Okay.
We could be some Fidelity
some or family of funds.
Sure.
Okay.
And
the other products.
Most of your DC and plans will have a choice of between 15 and 20 funds within that
right.
lineup. And you know, the two things is you'll have a group insurance platform, a group GA, or an open architecture platform. And then you'll potentially have an RIA involved in that investment selection with the company trustees. So it you know, the DC plan, you know, it can be more complicated. It doesn't have to be, right? You know, you can also do, you know, I was talking to a small business today, it's 7 employees. He did a DC plan as a recruitment tool, and he does a 5% match, very generous. And it's truly, it's a retention recruitment tool, and it's a very simple plan. It's very, you know, low maintenance for him. But again, you can do a DC plan at that level, too. It's just, you know, it really goes back to what you're trying to do as the employer and what type of, back to Sven, I mean, what type of market you're in and who you're having to attract and not attract all comes into play.
And can I ask one other? Are the customers you're typically dealing with for-profit enterprises, or are they also tax-exempt or nonprofit organizations?
I've done both. I mean, I've used the TSA or the 403B rules have changed over the last several years, so they're a little more complex. But both plans can be worked in the profit or nonprofit sectors. Some nonprofit sectors use 401ks and TSAs in the same setting.
Sven, could you push the mic just a little way? They're really sensitive. That's probably about right there. Thanks. Not your fault.
That was what I want to get across.
Okay. Well,
so.
Could I want to ask Sven one
yeah.
more question, if I could. So as you are surveying the landscape of potential targets, marketing targets, potential leads, is it fair to say that a larger employer is a better prospect for you than a small employer? Or to put it more gently, are there disincentives to reach out to certain types of companies? I mean, time is money. Money pays the bills. Are there certain types of employers that are more likely to fall through the cracks as we look at, you know, the array of products that are out there? Obviously, if you sell 401ks, you're not going to go to a small employer.
Generally not. I think there's a lot more people in my business. They tend to work more in the larger employer market, and a lot of my business is also is individual retirement planning with clients and so forth. So it's easy for me to work into their small business as well. But I would not say it's crowded necessarily in the small, this the way I've just defined 25 and under small business market. It is more can be more lucrative in a larger business, but that's where there's a lot more competition in that world as well. So, and they're more difficult, those plans are more difficult to work with. But then if you move a plan that has a lot of assets, there's certainly a much higher profit for the advisor that's working in that area. So
I was just trying to think, you know, as we were listening to the representative from California,
mm-hmm.
they made some very obvious exclusions, and I was trying to figure out how that squares with the interests and the needs of your industry. Are there cultural barriers to participating in retirement plans that we should be aware of?
I think so, for sure. In fact, Grant made a comment, I didn't really focus on it, but he mentioned Latino. And what I noticed in our area is that there's a number of different elements of Latino culture, it seems. And of course, I'm not an expert in the area, just in working with them in business. But there are some that are highly integrated and into the, you know, the business world and so forth, and others that have kind of found a niche for themselves in the business world, but have maintained a real distinction in their culture. And then there's others that maybe are newer in the area or whatever, and they are less comfortable with some of these, as I mentioned earlier, intangible products. So I think that is a cultural barrier. And, I mean, that's all I sell is intangible products. I mean, life insurance, investments. You can't see or touch or taste that stuff.
That's true. You know, it's interesting the way you phrase that, because one of the things I've been thinking about is we haven't talked about startups. And if you think about startups, it's really tough to do a plan when you start a company. So, what I've seen lately is it's usually 3 to 5 years after a company has started, then they go, okay, now I'm ready to look at my benefits package and start figuring out what I want to do there. But, you know, those first couple of years, they're just heads down trying to get the product out or trying to get the revenue going. I think it's also something we got to consider as well.
What is the industry's reaction to the MYRA? Do they see that as being a significant factor or not being a significant? How does it change the playing field?
I don't know if I'm qualified to speak for the entire industry, but I think it's I don't know that it's taken significant as a significant move forward. It's because it's a fairly small contribution that can be made. We have contributions that can be made to Roth IRAs and traditional IRAs already, and we have some other. There's a lot of other products. I don't know. It's fairly new. I think we just heard about, you know, several months ago at a, you know, in the president's address to the nation. So it's still kind of being disclosed what it's all about.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
A few years ago, I don't know how many, but the 401ks were modified so that an employer could have create a 401k without a contribution. Just an employee could do pre-tax some percentage of their salary or a flat amount on a regular basis. Has that product increased in utilization since it was made available, and has that eroded from what you understand the business? Has that eroded, as that comes in, has that eroded participation in the more traditional 401ks where there's a match? Or
so you're asking about the difference between pre-tax and the Roth?
No,
the individual 401k where the employer can create it, but there's no employer contribution to it. It's just it makes it accessible to the employee, and they can make a pre-tax contribution to it.
I think those exist probably in larger companies. It's not a plan that I've offered in the past, because, I mean, traditionally with the 401k, the employer, the owner, has some incentive to do the participate, and they want to participate at a high level. And if they do that, then there's weighting, testing, and so forth. There has to be so many participants in the non-ownership group to equal out the benefits. So, generally, there's some type of a matching that's involved, but there are large companies that have the 401ks that I know have dropped the match and so forth, especially several years ago, and maybe bring it back. But I don't know that I can comment on that with really any professional certainty.
All right, we have about 10 minutes left.
Thank you guys, appreciate it.
Do you want to go on to the next? Thanks, you guys, very much appreciated.
So the other question that Jen asked is, you know, is there any savings guidelines that people should be thinking about? I just pulled out two simple ones that, you know, you hear a lot about, you read a lot about, and, you know, the newspaper. But, you know, the 8 times your last salary from Fidelity, they have a model there that basically, you know, to provide 85% of your replacement income at your salary that you're making when you retire. You know, there's a lot of complications then when you get to that, because you say, okay, 8 times, you know, it depends when you start, it depends when you retire, it depends what your annual savings were, what your length of time in retirement, you know, could be. So if you're retired at 60 or 70, huge difference there. And one of the things that their model also assumes is Social Security is part of that model. So, you know, a lot of times most benchmarks, you'll see Social Security is still included in those benchmarks, so people are still assuming it'll be still available and there for people. But the 8 times, you know, you think about someone making $40,000 a year, it's, you know, potentially $320,000. Think about some things Grant said earlier, you know, probably not that far off for a 25-year, 30-year retirement. So the other one you'll hear about is, you know, say 15% a year. You know, that comes out of a couple different research areas, Employee Benefit Research Institute that Grant mentioned earlier, and also the American College in Pennsylvania has done a lot of modeling around this. And some, you know, and the difference here becomes, okay, is employer match included in that or not? So, you know, that becomes also part of how people have to think about it, is what is that employer match? Is that part of your 15% or not? The problem is you can't really say what is a benchmark, because it's all back to what's the individual circumstance going on. So if you have, you know, high medical costs, if you have a lot of dependents, if you have a lot of family that you're trying to support, all those factors come into play on how much do you need to have a sum at retirement that you can feel comfortable that you'll not outlive. So, you know, what we always try to tell people is, you know, talking to people like Sven and Roger, or especially Sven at the individual level, it's really critical, but also trying to do some type of analysis with a financial planner to really figure out, you know, what you need. And you'll read a lot, you know, a lot of trade magazines, a lot of articles will talk about registered investment advisors and what is their role. Is their role growing or not? And it really is growing in how they try to help people plan out, okay, what is that retirement and what's that going to look like? And what is your spending habit going to be? Are you going to take more trips? You know, so all those things have to come into play in trying to get to it. But these two numbers here give you at least a ballpark on helping people get to a guideline. Any questions on that? So my last one is, I went back and reread the 1997 report from the task force. And one of the things I found interesting and totally agree with what Grant said before, you know, it is behavioral finance that has to drive what happens. But education has to be part of it. You can't just stop doing education, because you got to keep building that awareness so that people, it's top of mind. And so one of the things, you know, I look at what we did with the Oregon 529 and the amount of advertisement that went with it and still goes with it, right? You know, we're still doing a lot of publicity around the 529. You know, stop smoking, don't do drugs. You know, we've been talking about these things for years, but you have to keep them fresh and you got to keep them in front of people so that action continues to happen. You know, so I do think the educational long-term program they developed in that 1997, it's still relevant today. I mean, all those things they listed are still things that are viable today in the issues that we're facing. And then the last thing, just to get on my little soapbox again, I mean, the payroll deduction program is the first lever. So if companies aren't having a payroll deduction program, it's really tough to actually do any of these other things mandatory, because, you know, now they got to be able to have someone send out all that money, be able to do all those transfers. And there's probably still a lot of companies that aren't using an automated payroll program. So we just got to think about that. And I don't know what those numbers are, but that is something that is the first lever before you get to anything else, because people got to be able to do it at point of payroll. That's when they take the most action.
Do you have a sense of, would the Department of Revenue be the right place to figure out? I mean, I'm wondering where the receptacle of data on percentage of payroll deduction.
That's what I'm thinking. It would probably be them.
Is that something we could dig into?
Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know what the state of Oregon's, because we have so many small businesses, I don't know what that.
Yeah, I don't have a sense either, Harley. That's a good question.
I mean, payroll deduction for these kinds of plans, is that?
Well, auto payroll deduction, right?
The capability.
Employer level.
Yeah. How many companies do it by hand versus right. How many companies use a computer to calculate all their.
Yeah, and because it becomes, now you're talking about it's this cash that has to go into an account. You know, there's a little bit more fiduciary issues around that. So,
good point. Great. Nobody signed up for public testimony today. Anybody want a last shot at that? Great. Any further questions or discussion? If you wouldn't mind, Jan, could you run us through the scope of the next meeting? I just want to make sure that everybody's okay with what we've got laid out for the next meeting. And if not, maybe people could suggest some alternatives.
best practices is kind of the theme of the next meeting, and we've extended an invitation to a expert at, I'm slipping here, I think it was Boston College, David John. He's with ARP, and Brookings, and he'd been with the Heritage Foundation for some time. So we're waiting to hear back as to whether he'll be able to come, if he is an expert in the field of best practices. And any suggestions you have for people to speak on that subject of best practices, it's similar to what we have been talking about today, auto-escalation, auto-enrollment. So we'll be developing that. That's May 14th. The following meeting in June, we've invited and they've accepted somebody from the Department of Labor, the district office in Seattle, that is the unit that handles ERISA, EBSA, it's Employee Benefit Security Administration. So they will be coming down to make a kind of a broad presentation on ERISA and answer your general questions.
Does that sound right, Track? Good. I've got a series of articles that I'm going to hand out. I just have an automatic propensity to look at these kinds of things. You can read them and enjoy them or throw them away or use them for scratch paper or whatever else. But they're all directly retirement security oriented, different points of view, different perspectives. And I thought these were particularly interesting and provocative articles, so I thought I'd pass them on for the good of the order.
Okay.
And I added.
Can I actually pass this out?
Yeah,
to you guys,
please. That'd be so great. Thanks for doing that.
Thanks.
That's great. Spare time and reading.
I think below your agenda, you had a one page that said summary of select statistics. I just put together some information that came most all national level about the access to plans in the private sector, how it varies by full time, part time, size of business. Some information on the Retirement Confidence Survey and looking at the trends in whether employers are offering defined contribution or defined benefit plans. And this is very general, but it's all linked. If you are looking at it on our OLIS system, it's all linked, so you could go to each survey, each study for greater detail.
That's fantastic. Great. Jan, thank you for your great work on this. Any further business? We're adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.